Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Tonight, our speaker will be Vanessa Abel. The talk is titled, The Giggles. Everyone, welcome Vanessa.
Thank you, Bonnie. Thank you, everybody. Nice to see everybody this evening. So tonight I'm talking about the giggles. I really like funny people. I like people who can tell good jokes. I kind of worship people who can tell good jokes in a little way. Like, I just sort of look up to them and think they're amazing, because I like to laugh and because I'm not particularly very good at telling jokes myself or even remembering them. So a good and active sense of humor is a thing to be admired in my book. And I've always been very strongly drawn to it. So I was thinking about this talk and I was talking about it with my husband, that I was thinking about funny things and jokes. And so he sent me a YouTube compilation of the Dalai Lama just being funny. And you sort of forget just how funny the Dalai Lama can be. He's just got such a great sense of humor when you see him interviewed. And in the compilation, there was this one interview with this lady called, maybe you know her, it might be just a thing because I'm not so familiar with TV personalities, but a lady called Nora O'Donnell. Yes, no, I'm familiar. Anyway, she was interviewing him back in 2013. And I think everyone gets a little bit nervous when they're interviewing the Dalai Lama, you know, they're a little bit like, And she's asking him these questions like, so you're celibate and you don't drink. And he's like, yeah. He's like, you don't take tobacco, you don't smoke. He's like, yeah. He's like, you're vegetarian. And he's like, yeah. And then so she says to him, so how do you have fun? And he says, I take drugs. And it was wonderful. And then he just laughed and laughed and he made her laugh. And I love him. What a guy. So it's important to laugh. And at the moment, I find I don't laugh so much. I miss it. I miss having really good belly laughs, because when you do, it feels good, right? And you get that really good physical feeling and that kind of wave that goes through your brain, the endorphins, and you can feel very relaxed and focused after a good laugh. And I'm also somebody who's very susceptible to getting the giggles, which is a little bit different from laughing. Does anybody else get the giggles sometimes? Or I can see Janet giggling. The giggles. School is where you get the giggles, I think. School is when you first start to get the giggles. For me, around my, I guess what would be high school here, around my teens. And really, I think they're among the best laughs I ever remember having were when I was at school, mostly when I was not supposed to be laughing, which for me begins to touch on the definition of giggles. I had a good friend at school who was like my giggling partner, and we would just giggle. we loved being in each other's company. I'd get to school early and so would she, and so we just sort of sit there before class kind of being like teenagers, and then we just sort of find funny things that nobody else really found very funny. But it amused us and it kind of kept us up. And then we'd stay late after school and And we even actually started doing an after-school Latin class together, just so that we could kind of spend more time in this state of mirth together. And this poor teacher who used to teach the Latin class, who had to deal with the two of us, who had to separate us probably every class. Because of course, the more serious the class, just the more incentive there was towards sort of just losing it and collapsing. And it didn't necessarily have to be anything funny. I remember one particular history class when we were doing a module about the history of medicine, and we were learning about cholera, and how the vaccine for cholera was initially tested on chickens. And then the history teacher asked us to do kind of a sketch in our notebooks for some reason of chickens. So my friend and I sort of faced with this task of having to draw these poor chickens that had just died of cholera. It became an extremely amusing point that I remember very well. And I was actually sent out of the class. So like unattached did I become to my sanity in that moment. And it was classrooms, it was school assemblies, church services, moments in the dining room when we had to be very quiet, during talks and presentations, like all those very, very serious moments when we're expected to be quiet and behave. And I don't think it's a coincidence that this started for me anyway in my teens, because I think it's a moment when you sort of, you know, you start to open your eyes and become wise to the artifice of institutions. You know, the things that maybe in your childhood you took for granted as being real and authoritative, they suddenly seem to be very flawed human constructs. The teachers are people. And it could be a little rattling also, because you can have this idea that the life ahead of you is just going to be a series of roles, you know, a series of these kinds of situations where you have to play a particular part and behave. And I think that's quite a lot to take on for a young person. I think especially when, while having this realization, they're obliged to keep up the pretense and play the game. I think it builds a lot of pressure. And there's lots of ways to release that pressure. But I think for sure the healthiest and most legal way would be laughing. And those kinds of giggles that happened like in the Latin classroom, they were so corporal, you know, it was something that would just take over my whole body. It was uncontrollable. And crying and, you know, shaking and trying to keep it in. And the more you try to keep it in, the more it comes out, the more it builds up. And you'd reach some kind of composure, and then I'd catch my friend's eye and we just set each other off again. But when I go back to that feeling, when I think how that felt like in my belly and my bones, I realized it was such an essential moment, that it was a very dynamic moment of, it's a kind of a rapture, like the uncontrollableness is kind of a rapture and a rupture. Because in so much as giggles are different from laughing, you know, our teachers were not stand-up comedians, nobody was telling us jokes. But I think what felt funny or what felt uncomfortable in that moment was the contradiction between who we were and who we were expected to be. And the giggles kind of released that tension in the moment. So I'm sure I'm not the only person here who's a fan of Alan Watts, an occasional fan of Alan Watts. And one of his talks that has touched me the most, that I felt that I could relate to the most, is one called The Joker. Does anybody know that talk? The Joker. It's built on one of his favorite themes, which I think I would summarize with one of his recurring questions, which was, is it serious? Is it serious? And often when he posed that question, he would differentiate between sincerity and seriousness, being sincere and being serious, there being a difference between the two. And in this talk, The Joker, he talks about the historic figure and the function of the fool. So fools, as I found out recently, and I really didn't know this, that they've actually kind of been a social function in pretty much every like recorded, like historically recorded society, at least the major ones that I could understand. So Roman society, like old Chinese society, Indian, Japanese, Africa, Native America, Central America, everywhere within these worlds, there's been the figure of a fool in some sense or another. The most common one that springs to mind is the medieval sort of British court with the king and the courtiers and the fool, the jester, who was a permanent fixture in the court. And this was a tradition for centuries, at least in England, and not just in the court. Families, like rich families, you know, people who had the big houses and lots of land and names and subjects, they would also have fools at home and jesters. And so the fool wasn't just somebody who wore silly bells on their hat and juggled and told bad jokes. Like they performed a very sophisticated function. They had this role for truth telling, you know, for keeping it real. The fool would sort of be divested of all normal political standing, and they wouldn't have social status in the way that other people in the court or other people in the household would have. So the fool was very much a person on the outside, you know, a person who had nothing to lose, a kind of a person with no skin in the game. So from the king's point of view or from the family's point of view, they could be trusted, kind of like an insider outsider. So in the words of Alan Watts, that the fool is there to remind the monarch of his humanity also. So he would never get too stuffy. So the fool's kind of there to keep things light. And it would be something like the equivalent of a grinning skull, like a skull that a monk would traditionally keep on their table in their cell to remind them of their mortality so they wouldn't forget. And the fool isn't mean. He doesn't deride people in that way. He just kind of pokes fun, pokes holes in things. Pokes holes in power, in institutions. So the standpoint of the fool is that all institutions are games, which takes me back to teenagehood, when we were foolish, when I felt foolish, and I was repeatedly told that I was foolish by people around me. You're foolish. So I was thinking about this, and then what came to mind was the figure of the fool, the archetype of the fool, especially in the tarot tradition, which I really know nothing about, very, very little about. But I was interested to just look up the image of the fool within the tarot tradition. And if you know, or if you look at the tarot card of the fool, he's this sort of young man, looking very happy, very hopeful, kind of innocent, childlike figure, full of optimism. And he looks like he's about to set off on a journey. So he has like a small knapsack in one hand and a white flower in the other hand. And he's about to set off. But right there at the beginning of the journey, where he's standing and taking his first step, he's standing on the edge of a cliff. And he's bouncing and he's looking up and he's like, whoa. And he doesn't see what's about to happen. And so obviously it's really easy to draw similarities between the fool, I mean, you know where I'm going, right? The fool and the monk, right? And the bodhisattva. Because in the Zen tradition, you know, there's lots of figures. The holy fools, you know, poets like Ryokan or Ikkyu, or the Chinese poets like Han Shan, Layman Pang. These are all sort of people who left their ordinary lives. Layman Pang just put all his family's possessions on a boat and sunk it or set it on fire or something and just took his whole family off on a tour of the monasteries. And they're often sort of depicted as these very kind of, you know, rowdy, slightly out there characters, like to tipple. I think EQ was famous for going to brothels. But they were outsiders. You know, they were outside of the mainstream. Peripheral. And wise and speakers of the truth. You know. Their job was to, like the fool, was to reveal the artifice of what they saw and to provide relief with no concern for themselves or no concern for their social reputations because they had none. And like the fool, you know, at the beginning of his journey, there's this theme of innocence, of beginner's mind. Because the monk and the bodhisattva and the fool, I think what they have in common is recognizing the game. Recognizing the game. And I think especially in the case of the bodhisattva and the monk, is recognizing the game and choosing to play it. And choosing to play it with a lot of enthusiasm. So when I look at the funny people in my life and I admire them and I think to myself, I wonder, like, how do they do it? You know, like, how, what's their secret? Like, we'll be in the same situation and we'll come out and we'll talk about it afterwards and they'll say, oh, did you notice, you know, this? And it'll be very funny. And I'm like, I didn't think of that. It's really funny. And what I realized that it has a lot to do with framing, right? It's framing. Like, that's how... When we're in our ordinary lives, like when you go through your day, when whatever you're perceiving, whatever's coming up in front of you, you're framing it. Like you're taking it in, you're letting certain things in and you're keeping certain things out. Pessimistic people tend to let in more darkness. Optimistic people tend to let in more light at the cost of maybe leaving out a little darkness. And sometimes I think, you know, the people who have humor, you know, who have this kind of more world, I almost feel like the frame is larger, you know, it takes in more things, it allows in more contradictions. And within that, I think there's also a difference, you know, often I very often, you know, if I frame a story, I'll cast it and I'll cast myself as the hero. You know, the person who did well or did the just act or who did the right thing. And sometimes I think, you know, with that alternative way of framing, the person is very often casting themselves as the anti-hero. You know, there's no sense of, I guess, that kind of social standing that I was talking about earlier. So that's the There's a lot of relief in that for me, in that kind of framing that reminds us that, well, the institutions, you know, these things that we take terribly seriously can be seen as games. And it's a very pertinent idea right now at this moment, because for the most part, like, our institutions are down, right? Schools and churches and libraries. So my question, I have a question, and it's, how is this, what's happening now, this pandemic, how is it framing our world? Like, what's in that frame? You know, it's undermining our world. It's undermining what we thought our world was. It's reminding us of our mortality, of impermanence. It's revealing the shortcomings of institutions. And on the other side, it's given us some relief, maybe, from the roles that we play, from the obligations that might be holding us captive, right? And it's an outsider. It came from the outside and it has no skin in the game at all. So these are the things I've been thinking about for the last 6 months. I've been doing a lot of reframing, a lot of rethinking of these things. And maybe you have too. I think we all have. I think that pretty much every human culture at some point has curried visions and fantasy tales of the apocalypse. But really, these last few weeks here in the West Coast of America, we had a little preview of that, I think, you know. I mean, the sky literally turned orange last week. And it was chilly. You know, it was cold. There was that chill that it wasn't the chill of winter, but it was like, it was the absence of warmth. It was the absence of the sun. You know, it was a different kind of cold that to me felt like death. It was a strange kind of cold. And I think it's been on our minds and it's seeping into our bodies. It's seeping into our bones. And so things might feel a little chaotic, a little anarchic, a bit like we're teetering on the brink of something. Maybe like we're about to step off a cliff. And it's kind of an air of tragedy, right? Because tragedy is about loss, and tragedy is about when things don't end well, when things are irreversible, when the outcome is irreversible. That, to me, that's kind of how I interpret tragedy. And tragedies, plays, they have actors, they take place on a stage. Shakespeare, who was a master of creating stage tragedies, he always had a fool in all of his plays. I think pretty much every play that I can think of, even the comedies, you know, there was always a fool. And the fool, that Shakespeare's fool, had various functions. So there were three functions that I kind of singled out for Shakespeare's fools. The first one would be comic relief. So I'm thinking of Hamlet, which is my favorite Shakespeare play. And there's a scene with the gravediggers in Hamlet, just after Ophelia, who's Hamlet's love, and she commits suicide. She kills herself. And the scene is the gravediggers are there, and they're, you know, the common man. They're talking in a completely different kind of level of language from the nobility of the rest of the cast. So they're sort of appealing to the audience in that way. And they're digging, you know, they're digging this woman's grave and making jokes. And Hamlet comes along and he doesn't realize at that moment still what's happened. He doesn't know that this woman's dead, that he loves. And even worse, that these people are digging her grave. So in that case, I could go on, but in that case, it's a break, you know, from one very tragic event to another. It's a little moment to just laugh. Another function of the fool, I don't know how many people are familiar with King Lear. I'm not overly familiar, but the fool in King Lear is this person who is very trustworthy to the king, a bit like how I talked about before, because he's keeping it real. Like he's the truth teller. You know, he's not afraid. Everybody else is afraid to speak their mind to the king, you know, to show the mirror up to the king. But his fool isn't. And even though he says things that if other people said them to the king, it would anger the king, the fool kind of gets a pass because the king trusts him and because the king's not threatened by him. And then I think the third function of the fools in that kind of dramatic setup with Shakespeare is that they're there to remind the audience that they're watching a play. So, you know, often these plays would go on for 3, 4, 5 hours. And I think people would become so absorbed in them, you know, a bit like when you go to the cinema and you're a very, very absorbing movie. And I think there's a moment sometimes when things get a bit too much where you're like, whew, you know, I need a breather. I need to keep my eye on the ball and remember what this is. And that's what the fools would do, or the jesters, you know, they would sort of come in and be like, whew, this is pretty tough going. Yeah, but remember, it's just a play. It's fine. So for the audience, you know, by going into the theater, by purchasing a ticket, you've agreed to something. You've agreed to playing this game and watching this and kind of suspending your disbelief in that moment. There's an agreement. And to me, at least, you know, I think one of the ways that I think about institutions is like this. It's kind of an agreement. It can extend out from, you know, like I mentioned, schools, churches, libraries, courts, to, you know, social institutions like marriage, or things like currency, time, lots of other aspects of our culture. Canando, you know, the place where we come and practice, is a kind of institution. We have certain agreements in place by which we operate. We're silent and mindful when we come to the Zendo in person. We bow. We walk around the space in a particular way. We don't bring our phones inside. We leave them in the car. So we've agreed to draw certain lines and behave in a certain way. And then the bell rings and we're done and we leave. And we go back to our cars, and maybe we check our phones, or we turn on the music really loud, and we kind of exhale, and that's it. That game's over. That game's over for now. And then we go on to another game that we call work or home. So some of the things we do within the context of different institutions might be very unique and particular to that institution, you know, to a particular institution or a particular game. You know, back to what we do in the Zendo, we might not universally advocate the practice of walking around a room in a clockwise direction around the edges in every situation of our lives, but we agree to do so in the context of the Zendo. So we agree to temporarily suspend our disbelief in that context, like when we're watching a play or a movie. And so we can understand it in that way as a construct, and we don't take it too seriously, but we can play it with a lot of enthusiasm. And I would say that probably after school, the next situation that I've been in that has given me the most giggles has definitely been within Zen practice, usually Sesshin. So I think for me, Sesshin is just one of the most giggle-inducing situations in existence. And maybe you experience this as well, I don't know. But for me, on pretty much every sesshin, usually a little further into it, not right at the beginning, usually when sort of you made a little inroad into the sesshin, there's a moment when suddenly everything is so funny, so, so funny. And it'll be quiet, and everyone's sitting zazen, very quietly and very calmly, very concentrated. And I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, if I make so much as a peep, everyone will hear me. And the spell of the Zazen and the whole session is going to collapse. Even if I just let out a tiny snigger, everyone's enlightenment is on the line. It's all over. And there's just nothing funnier. There's just nothing funnier. And I shake, tears pouring down my cheeks. And if the teacher caught me at that moment, Abel, what's so funny? Share it with the group. You know, what would you say? I mean, there's nothing to say. There's nothing to explain there. It's not funny, but it's funny. And I wouldn't have had an answer, but that's the real essence of giggles. You know, it's very personal. It's very intuitive. And then going back to institutions or the idea of institutions just for a moment, there's another thing that Alan Watts puts forward that I kind of really vibe with. And that's looking at yourself as an institution, you know, by the same definition. So our identities being formed through agreed upon shared social signifiers and reflections. So I'm a woman, I'm a mother, I'm a Zen student, I'm a housewife, right? And these are just shared signifiers, you know, to give you some idea of, you know, how I spend my hours and days. But these signifiers can also be tyrannical if you take them too seriously, or they would be for me if I took them too seriously. So for me, my question is, you know, so often, how can I undermine that? How can I play the fool to myself? How can I ensure that this institution of the self for me doesn't become stuffy? You know, that I take it too seriously and I forget that, well, it's just a construct. So the shocking proposition that this brings me to, or like an idea that I'm playing with, is this. So from the inside of being inside of a global pandemic right now and an environmental tragedy and a political crisis, would it be irreverent right now? Would it be heartless to get the giggles? Would that bring the house down? Would it bring on the final act? Or might it help? I don't know. I do not know. I'm just putting it out there. I really don't know. But what I do know is that there's something very dear to me in the figure of the fool. Bonnie, are you there? By any chance, I'd just like to share my screen for a second.
Sure.
Thank you.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah? Thank you. I was just going to show you a picture before, so everyone can easily Google that later, because they're all the same. Like, I always thought that all the tarot cards would look very different, but they all look the same, so you'll know what I'm talking about. But I just love this picture. I'm going back to it now just to finish off. But this resiliently hopeful character of the fool, and he's a little bit mad, you know, he's a little bit unhinged, a bit like Don Quixote, you know, battling the windmills. That's what he's like. He's traveling light, and he has this very optimistic, very humorous way of framing the world. He tells the truth because owning nothing, he owns nothing. He's got nothing to lose. All he has is just this little knapsack that he's carrying with him over his back. And, oh, thank you. Can everyone see that? Yeah. And you can see in his other hand, so he's twirling this little white flower, which all Buddhists will think, aha, the twirling the flower, vulture beak, Buddha twirling the flower. But don't know, seems like a funny coincidence that that's what he's doing. And you can look at his foot. You know, he's about to fall off the edge of a cliff. I mean, the man is one step away from annihilation, but he doesn't die. And I'll leave those of you who are interested to go ahead after this session and go and look up the story of the fool's journey. It's a long and protracted arc, and he has lots of adventures and lots of ups and downs. But the spoiler, which I'm going to tell you now, is that he does not meet his doom in the next step that occurs after this picture. He does not end up in a pile of bones at the bottom of the cliff. He might fall over the precipice. He might fall into the darkness. He might fall into the unknown. But that is just the beginning of his journey. And the end of my talk. Thank you. And if anybody has any questions or comments or really good jokes to tell, now is a really good moment. Thank you. Dave.
Thank you so much for your talk, Vanessa. It was wonderful, and I personally enjoyed it very much because I've been absolutely fascinated with humor for a very long time. I mean, we all enjoy it, but there's a lot of very interesting stuff about, you know, I mean, humor is a pretty uniquely human thing. If you think about our emotions, you know, we've got fear and hunger and sadness and anger and all of those things. And we share those with a lot of other animals, but it's not clear that humor, as we really define it for humans, is very close to anything that any other animal. Perhaps some of the higher primates have something vaguely similar, but it's a uniquely human thing. And it's kind of interesting to think about, you know, where that came from in a biological sense. But what you were saying earlier about Alan Watts reminded, there's a wonderful quote I'm sure you're familiar with from Oscar Wilde, where he says, life is much too important to be taken seriously. And I think that whole idea of sort of puncturing the illusions, especially when you talked about the function of the king's fool. And it seems like there are two things about this that you mentioned. One is playing the fool to yourself so that you don't take yourself and all of your assumptions about life too seriously. You're always willing to stop and reframe. And then there's the other thing, which seems particularly conspicuous by its absence in certain parts of our society right now. I'm thinking particularly of the White House, where you have someone, and I don't know how this relates to the history of the king's gesture, like, were there kings who had jesters and others who simply killed their jesters and didn't walk them around? But it seems like it would be really good if we had, you know, a jester in the White House right now, although it obviously wouldn't work given the personality of the current resident of the White House. There was a very interesting quote that I heard recently from someone who was talking, he's a political satirist, and he was talking about the basic theory of political satire. You know, what is political satire? And he said, basically, political satire, I mean, it's fulfilling a lot of the functions you talked about, but he said the fundamental structure of it is that you take reality and you just crank it up and exaggerate it in order to make a deeper point. And he said, how do you do that when the American electorate has decided to arm a game show host with nuclear weapons? And I guess I'm just really sort of stuck at this point, not just in terms of, you know, making fun of Donald Trump, but we all run into people who really could use some deflation and reframing of their outlook on the world. And in many cases, they're not the least bit receptive to that. Is there any kind of skillful means that allows us to play that role, you know, to basically put our practice into the situation and help these people to maybe let loose just a little bit and play the fool for them? I personally find myself often in situations where I simply don't see how I can do that.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like, I mean, playing the fool involves sort of taking the first hit, oneself, you know? And I feel that in that sense, you know, if somebody is self-deprecating in that way, I find that that, in my experience, tends to disarm, or maybe just, you know, open a tiny little aperture, maybe, but not always. It definitely calls for skillful means, Dave. And you make me think about when you were talking about the White House, about the, is it the press dinner?
It's the correspondence dinner.
Correspondence dinner at the White House, which was a tradition, right? And every year the president would go and hear himself ripped to shreds by these comedians. And if I understand correctly, the current president has not attended one so far.
That's correct.
Yeah. So I think that's a great indication. You know, I think of I don't want to get too political, but I just think about, you know, a world a few years ago when there were terrorist attacks, for example, on the satire magazine in Paris, the Charlie Hebdo attacks, you know, and everybody thought, oh, you know, this is these people who attack satire and, you know, who attack humor. And yet, yeah, you know, to me, there's an echo in the seriousness of just not wanting to hear what's being said in that way. Obviously, I'm not comparing it to a terrorist attack, but I just mean it's an echo of the same kind of deliberate deafness.
Yeah.
I think look to the Dalai Lama. I have not seen a person that he can't make laugh. He just does it by laughing a lot himself, and it seems to work. Yeah.
Megan, and then me.
Well, I have a joke, which is a man goes to a bar and asks the bartender for 2 hurricanes and a Corona, and the bartender says that'll be 2020. Silly joke.
What about a wildfire?
Yeah, you forgot the wildfire.
That's great. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
May?
Thank you for your talk. I really enjoy it. Thank you for bringing up Alan Watts. Just briefly encounter him. But thank you for this little interest. So make me curious. Yeah, it's funny that I think the other day, I think my son is already 11 right now. I think a couple of years ago, we bring him to the Legoland. Oh my God, that was the most happiest moment, you know? And then Legoland, everything designed, it's just there's nonstop happiness, right? And then there's no single moment that you're not happy. I just that's his moment. There's a song, it's called, you know, you go to the elevator and then the elevator, the music starts to you know, sing. It's, everything's awesome, you know, that kind of everything's awesome. And now my son the other day, we started to sing, is everything is canceled, you know, everything's canceled. And then now I just feel like, hey, you know, still something's there, you know. just, I don't know, it's just love. The other end, it's, oh gosh, I forgot. Anyway, yeah, just everything is canceled, but I think it's still a happy moment. Yeah.
Right. Thank you, May. Do you mean to say, is your son able to find the humor? Is he able to?
I think we often just talk about fabulous. He always talk about the opposite. You know, if he describes something which is he's really depressing, for instance, their field trip has canceled. The field trip is actually, think about those kids that will spend a whole week in the desert. It's canceled. So he's pretty depressing, but he just used the word fabulous, you know, kind of thing. And then spectacular kind of thing. So to express his depression. So I'm like, hey, you know, you're interesting to choose the word. But anyway. Yeah.
Thank you. I've never been to Legoland. I took my daughter to Disneyland this Christmas.
Oh, it's different. I think especially like second grade, like 7, 8.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Yeah, I think the food. They do design for happiness. I mean, they do. So everything's awesome.
But in general, I think the Lego humor is quite sharp, isn't it? Like, I think it's another brand that maybe doesn't take itself so seriously or likes to poke fun from the Lego movies that I've seen.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Bonnie.
I had a comment about what Dave said, wondering whether animals have a sense of humor. So one day I was walking down a road and I saw this cow, and I just looked at this cow and I said, "Hey cow, do you have Buddha nature?" And the cow looked right at me and said, "Moo." So I thought that cow was pretty smart, enlightened, and had a sense of humor. I just wanted to hear that.
Yeah.
I saw that one coming before the punchline. any joke with a cow in it. Oh. Love it.
Dave?
Just quickly to follow up on what you just said, Bonnie, I'm sure you know the story about the student who went to his teacher and said, "Master, does a dog have Buddha nature?" And the master said, "Well, of course." He said, "Well, do I have Buddha nature?" And the master said, "No." He said, "Well, how come the dog has Buddha nature and I don't?" He said, "Because you had to ask."
Catherine?
Hi, Catherine.
Hi, this is my first time here. I think this is the way you ask for permission to talk. I saw Dave do that. But thank you, Vanessa, for the talk. It was enjoyable. And I had a joke for you or for everybody. But first, I wanted to tell you that I have been attending laughing yoga. And it is really great. It's great for your body and great for your mind. And it's like this on Zoom and 1 hour of laughing and different things. But I don't know, I started doing it a few weeks ago and I really like it. But anyway, my joke is, I usually like to tell people it's a dirty joke, but it's really not. I just like to tell them it's a dirty joke because it seems funnier to me. So the joke is, what's the difference between bird flu and swine flu?
No idea.
One, you get tweetment. The other one, you use ointment.
Dave. No.
Good joke. That's my favorite joke.
Thank you, Catherine. That's a great joke.
Yeah. If you're with adults, it's good to tell people it's dirty. Then it's a little funnier. But for kids, it's really good, too.
That is a good joke. I'll tell my daughter that one. And enjoy your laughing yoga, too.
Yeah, I have been.
Do they tell you lots of jokes? Or do you just sort of start like a momentum of laughing and then it just gets everybody laughing?
No, they have little things. You go through like little laugh exercises, like you start out little and then you get big, or There's one exercise where you get, you go like this and you go, ha, 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 ha. And I don't know. I just need to laugh during these times.
Well, thank you. Enjoy. I hope you get more out of that. That sounds great. Anybody else sitting on a joke or a question or a comment? I have a joke then that I will tell. This is a joke that I heard on the internet yesterday or the day before yesterday. It's a story joke. So there's been a sesshin or a, you know, a practice period or a sesshin, and everybody who's, you know, been sitting at the sesshin has been meditating a lot and doing things in a very mindful way, and doing things very slowly and walking very slowly and eating very slowly and just functioning very slowly. Things have really slowed down. That's the idea. So then the sesshin ends and everybody goes home. And one of the people who was at the sesshin works in a zoo. And so he goes back to work on Monday to the zoo. And he walks in very slowly to the zoo. And his boss sees him and he's like, what's up with this guy? And he says, well, I've just been on a meditation retreat and everything's very calm for me right now. So his boss thinks like, geez, I better keep an eye on this guy. I'm gonna give him a new job today. So he sends him over to the tortoise enclosure. He says, go spend the day at the tortoise enclosure. I think that's where you need to be today after your retreat. So the man goes off, and at about lunchtime, the supervisor sort of starts thinking, like, maybe I'll go and check on that guy, see if how he's doing with the tortoises. And he gets to the tortoise enclosure and the door to the enclosure is open and all the tortoises have gone. And the man's just standing inside the tortoise enclosure, kind of looking a bit startled. And he says to him, what happened? Where are the tortoises? And he says, I don't know. I just came. I opened the door and whoosh. Because the tortoises were moving very quickly in relation to the map. On that note, are we good? Are we out of time, Bonnie?
I think Les might want to say something.
Oh, sorry, Les. I didn't see.
No, just saying thank you.
Oh, okay.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Vanessa.
Thank you, Teresa.
Any other questions or comments before we close? All right, thank you, Vanessa.
This talk was brought to you by the Canando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N. D-O dot O-R-G.